From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea, and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live.
With Ben O'Shea.
The good book says you're supposed to turn the other cheek when someone wrongs you, but I'm finding that really hard to do when it comes to Liberal Upper House MP Nick Gorin. For those who don't know Gorin, he's the rabid Bible basher who tried to delay WA's voluntary assisted dying laws back in 2019. He lodged 357 amendments to the VAD bill, 357, something Premier Mark McGowan described as disgraceful and worse than filibustering. Then old mate Gorin was outed as a member of the Clan, the group of Liberal power brokers who were playing secret squirrel on WhatsApp. Gorin made disparaging remarks about female Labor MPs in that group chat, which I gotta say isn't very Christian. Now we find out Gorin has put his hand in his pocket to pay Facebook to boost a post of his about the vaccine mandate. Surprise, surprise, he was using his platform to undermine the vaccine rollout. Coercion was the word he used to describe WA's proposed vaccine mandate for workers. He went on to say he supported vaccination, which is all well and good until you realise that statement came from one of only two MPs in the WA Parliament who refused to reveal whether they've had the jab or not. Gorin knows full well that his Facebook post was a dog whistle, so I'd love for him to explain to me how he's any different from Queensland Liberal MP and renowned plonker George Christensen, or even Clive Palmer. People like this are going to be on the wrong side of history when we look back at the COVID-19 pandemic. But in the meantime, they sure are making a nuisance of themselves. Coming up on the show, we'll unpack the sting operation that has nabbed WA bikies. Plus, how should you talk to your kids about Clio? And the WA food industry is putting on its biggest show ever. But first, let's see what's making news.
The West Live. Making news.
Joining me now in the studio is Sunrise correspondent Matt Tinney. G'day, mate.
G'day, mate. Happy Taco Tuesday.
Taco Tuesday. All right, let's jump straight in.
How's Elsa's going?
Yeah, I haven't touched base with them for a while. Okay. No, but we've got some big food news coming up later this week, so just keep your powder dry on that one. And now let's jump straight into this story about Cleo Smith that we all know about now, the little girl who went missing from her parents' tent in Carnarvon last Saturday. What's the latest on this story?
Yeah, 10 days this search has been going for. Still no sign of Cleo Smith. Her mother, Ellie, and stepdad have appeared on Flashpoint, Channel 7's Flashpoint last night, pleading for whoever snatched Cleo to bring her home. They are obviously immensely affected by this. It was heart-wrenching to watch them go through it. You know, obviously completely emotional. They haven't left the Blowholes campsite there, I'm told. Going home is just not a prospect for them at this point. They can't even manage doing that. And they don't live that far away. Obviously, they're from the region. So they're hoping that by appealing to people across the nation, this interview is being seen across the nation, that somebody will come forward with some information. Somebody will know something, and that will be a lead. We've seen things come to light, her voice appearing on CCTV. We've heard about the vehicle that was seen leaving the Blowholes campsite, so little tidbits of information. The $1 million reward, we're told, has even sparked bounty hunters to head up that way to try to find her. So the police are really hoping that by the parents, Cleo's mum Ellie especially, coming forward and talking about the suffering that she's going through, that it will be enough to prompt somebody to call up Crime Stoppers, call up police, and give that little piece of information that might be the difference between a family getting their little girl back or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And the idea of bounty hunters joining this investigation is an interesting wrinkle, and it's hard not to think that they're just going to get in the way of police.
Yeah, I was a bit flabbergasted by this. I mean, it feels like something out of America,
doesn't it? Like Dog the Bounty Hunter.
Yeah. I mean, but look,
he couldn't get into the country.
Look, if they find, does anybody really care how she's found at this point? She's found,
no.
You know.
But do we even have bounty hunters?
Well, it's just people who want the $1 million.
Amateurs.
Yeah,
oh, gosh. Look, if it generates anything positive, then that's obviously an amazing thing. But it's hard to imagine how the amateurs going up there are just not going to get under the feet of the professional investigators from the WA police who know what they're doing. Potentially those people could... just stuff up the investigation.
Well, and then, I mean, the other thing is we're talking 10 days now. Mm. It's not like she could potentially be anywhere, you know.
The
state. I mean, they're confident she's still in the state. That's the word from police.
Yeah, which I think is a pretty fair assumption given how hard it is to get out of WA right now.
Yeah, but how could nobody have seen her to this point, heard her, have a tiny bit of information? Somebody would know something.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, like eventually it'll get to a point where there is some acceptance of the worst case scenario, I think, here, that it's no longer a search for Cleo. It's a sort of a recovery situation, which, you know, is obviously a very difficult thing to talk about, but it seems to be the way these investigations tend to go.
Yeah, I mean, but also how many times have we seen these cases where people are taken and then locked up for, decades
it's
and then turn up and suddenly, you know, they're 35 and it's like, whoa.
Yeah, yeah, that definitely happens. Either option is really horrible to think about.
I'm sure everybody in WA is like this. The moment I think of this girl, it's just too much to bear to think what she's going through, has gone through.
It's very hard to do.
Especially,
you can't do it as a parent.
You can't do it as a parent. I've got a daughter who's very similar age, and I just think, how could somebody, A, do that, and B, like at this point, 10 days on, seeing the parents, seeing how gutted they are by this situation, not be compelled to turn this around.
Yeah, that's right. We just hope someone out there knows something. Yeah. And if you do, of course, you call Crime Stoppers on 1-800-333-000. Now, Maddie, now talking about parents' worst nightmares, this is a story that we always hate to see, a driveway tragedy.
Yeah, terrible story coming out of Dawesville. A three-year-old boy has died after a horror accident in the driveway of the family home on Kambalda Street. We're told the child was playing in the back of a ute. When he fell out of that ute and he has died, the three-year-old. So WA police are preparing a report for the coroner. Just terrible for this family down in Dawesville.
Yeah, and we know that this is an issue that is ongoing, child safety in driveways. It comes up every now and then. Every time it does, it's shocking and families are torn apart. It's, your heart goes out to the family involved in this case.
Oh, awful situation. I mean, in this case, we're told this child was playing in the back of the ute and has fallen out. We often see driveway tragedies when people are reversing and can't see the kids. There's obviously different products that you can get for your cars these days which automatically put the brakes on if it detects an object behind, which is perhaps something that's worthwhile for a lot of families with young children. But I even know, like, just backing out of my driveway, I can barely see the footpath behind me just because of, you know, the way the street is, and I'm always just going at the snail's pace because we just see these stories time and time again.
Here's a statistic for you. So on average, 7 pedestrians aged between 0 and 14 are killed each year and 60 seriously injured by being hit by a four-wheeled motor vehicle moving around a home. It's terrible, isn't it?
Terrible. Is that WA stats?
That's nationally.
Nationally, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just something that is so easy to happen, just takes a second of inattention or just a complete freak event.
And we're all just like in a rush these days, aren't we? You're like, get the car, seatbelt, kid, blah, 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 just off wherever I got to go.
Yeah, your heart just goes out to everybody involved in this situation.
Yeah. And I mean, anyone can, we don't know the exact circumstances, but, you know, people have always played in the ute before, in the back of a ute. That's not unusual. So it seems like, tragic accident.
Mm. And Lara Ellis, we know, launched a driveway safety campaign following the death of her child. So these things happen. You just hope it doesn't happen to you.
Yeah, just feel for that family.
And now, let's talk about the shooting in Gosnells yesterday. What do we know about that now?
Yeah, so at this point, we have major crime, we have Police Internal Affairs and the Corruption and Crime Commission all investigating this police shooting. The officers involved are on mandatory leave now. There's no judgment around that. That's just
standard,
what happens.
Standard procedure.
Standard procedure, what happens. Obviously, they receive counselling support and the like. There were a couple of officers injured in this incident. And police haven't revealed exactly what led up to it. We know that there were about 10 minutes between the time that they arrived after being called to a disturbance and the time of that fatal shot being fired. We understand that there was an altercation between two men, but police haven't revealed too much more about what was happening in their response. We do know, though, they tried capsicum spray, they tried a taser. So all of this will form part of the investigation.
Yeah, it's and the officers were injured as well. And I wonder if, you know, what we've seen played out in the media over the last couple of weeks about the murder trial of the police officer relating to JC plays into the minds of police when they involved in an incident like that. Do they think, well, do you know what? My training says to pull out the gun, but I'm wary of doing that based on what's been happening around town recently. Instead, I'm going to go for the capsicum spray. Instead, I'm going to go for the taser. It's definitely a difficult situation for police to find themselves in that situation.
I mean, and not to preempt what's going to happen with the investigation, but you would think that if an officer has tried the capsicum spray, has tried the taser, you know, they've taken those steps. They haven't just gone to the gun.
Yeah, the lethal force.
Yeah.
And now let's talk vaccination figures. You got any big milestones today?
Oh, almost 1,283,000, so it doesn't call for a sound effect today. 58.1% of the WA population 12 and over.
Oh, yeah. So when do you think we're going to get to 60% this week?
What are we up to? We're Tuesday. Yeah,
it may be Friday?
Well, might be the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Might be the weekend, I reckon.
60%. When I'm looking at some local government areas in New South Wales are now hit 90% double vaxxed. It's like, oh gosh, we're so far behind.
They are motoring ahead. Like even as their freedoms are obviously getting greater and greater, they're not slowing down on the vaccination.
Did you hear about South Australia today? They've announced their reopening without restrictions on December 3 because they expect to have 80% double vaxxed by then. And they've worked out that they're not that close to 80% right now. I think they're only at 62%, something like that. But they've said you have until Friday to get your first jab and then you'll have enough time to be double jabbed by December 3.
Yeah.
So they're not mucking around.
Well, isn't this what we've been calling for here slightly?
Yeah, well, that's why it's going to be super interesting to see what happens in South Australia.
But then
now,
what happens? So what happens with us to South Australia? Do we then strengthen the border with South Australia if they're opening up?
Like if Delta
What
gets
about
into
Queensland? Yeah. Queensland's opening up to everybody as well. Yeah. That's their plan. We're going at 12:01 a.m., so, you know, less than 24 hours to go, we're going to be downgrading our border to Queensland to very low risk. So you just have to fill out the form and away you go. No self-quarantine. So what happens when all of these other states open up to New South Wales and Victoria?
Like, I'm really starting to think we need to have a date to motivate people.
Where's the plan?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Why do we not have a
Mark
plan?
Mark McGowan knows it. He's not sharing it.
But why wouldn't you share it? Because we're in limbo land.
He's seen that he doesn't want to commit to something that then he has to, you know, backtrack on. He doesn't like to flip-flop on, and he would rather not say anything until he can say something definitive.
Well, what we've seen from the leaders over East in relation to opening up is they are sticking to it. That's what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to-ing and fro-ing. They're going, here's the date, we're doing it. You know, Perrottet came in, bang, okay. And the thing is, with New South Wales, their cases haven't gone up astronomically.
No, it's been, you know, their testing has gone down.
And this is the other question is the getting rid of compassionate reasons for travel. The basis of that was this 500 cases rolling average. That was the justification. They're well below that now. Why are we not having compassionate travel? If that was the justification, what's going on there?
282 new locally acquired cases in New South Wales today, which is really quite low. But the, you know, the testing is probably half.
I love how 282 is low. If we had one here, we'd freak out. But 282, but it is low. It's well below that threshold.
Below the rolling average. Now let's talk about this story. I can't believe we've saved this to the end because this should be the lead. So Armidale has fallen desperately short in its bid. I don't know if it was actually making a bid, but in its drive to become Australia's shittest suburb.
It's fallen short. I mean, you can't even win the shitter suburb.
Yeah, which you can make a case that you actually are the shitter suburb if you're
because
a
you haven't
up
been
shitter,
able to
in the
win
shit
it.
Towns of Australia
actually,
competition.
That's true. Have you looked through the other towns that are in there?
Yeah, I have. So Armidale could only manage fifth place on the shitter suburbs list. Mount Druitt in New South Wales took home the gong.
We all hear about Mount Druitt,
Mount
don't
Druitt
we?
Mount Druitt is pretty crappy, I have to say. Caboolture in Queensland, my home state. Yeah. Also, look, I wouldn't be going on holiday there.
Frankston in Melbourne.
Elizabeth in South Australia, lovely
That
name.
Sounds lovely. What's wrong with
obviously
Elizabeth,
not.
Everyone?
And then
Jimmy Barnes is from there.
Is he? Yeah. Is he? Well, obviously all went down.
The last,
he left.
Yeah, last
and then,
train
and then
out of
Armidale coming
gone.
In at fifth. And look, I think the problem with Armidale here is it's publicly voted, and I just think not enough people know how shit Armidale is.
Do you think they've gotten confused with the New South Wales town Armidale?
But that's also not great, though, isn't it?
Oh, I don't think it's that bad.
Oh, it's not.
Isn't it? Oh no, that's. I thought that's where Miranda Kerr's from, but it's around there. I don't think she's from.
And you know what? Last time we when they were nominated as one of the shittest towns in Australia, the local council reached out to me and said, "Would you like to come and have a round table with the mayor of Armidale to talk about all the great things that they're doing out there?"
Have you taken them up on that offer?
I was busy that week, but you know, I'm open to it. I'm open to it because I think, look, I think they do get a bit of a, you know, the rough end of the pineapple, Armidale. I think, you know, there's some positives out there.
What I'm hearing is next week there will be an outside broadcast of the West Live from Armidale.
Exactly. It's got some nice features down there in Armidale. So,
okay, you know, can you run through them, please?
The foothills. So it's the,
could you
know,
please
so nice.
Do today? Are you able to find out just a little exercise? Top five things to do in Armidale that we will discuss tomorrow
that don't involve buying meth.
Look, I've got to go. That's below the bar.
Maddie, thanks for joining us in the studio as always.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. I look forward to it. Have a good one, mate.
You're listening to the West Live.
And now, I'm very sad to confirm this morning some news that has shocked the WA media. Beloved ABC broadcaster Russell Wolfe has died overnight, aged 57. Joining me in the studio now is the West Australian's legal affairs editor, Tim Clark. Clarkie, we brought you in to speak about something else, but before we get onto that, we've got to talk about Rusty, who was a friend to many of us.
He's a friend to pretty much everyone who met him, I think. An amazing man, an amazing character, an amazing broadcaster, and just larger than life in more ways than one, you have to say. Absolutely devastating, shocking news. Every time you met Rusty, you always thought, I've got to go and see him again soon, because he was that type of character. He uplifted you. He was funny. He was generous on air and off. And you won't, I guarantee you won't find a bad word said about the man today, obviously, but at all, because he was just such a nice fella. And terrible news.
Yeah, and it came as a shock to all of his co-workers. And we're joined on the phone now by someone who spent a lot of years working with Rusty, former ABC broadcaster Glenn Mitchell. G'day, Glenn.
Mate, I wish I was joining you in better circumstances.
And so, it's hard to even imagine what the ABC family is feeling today. Many of the staff found out via email only a few minutes ago that this has happened. What's your memories of Russell?
Well, first of all, I'm down in my study downstairs, and my wife just knocked on the door and was in tears, and I thought something had happened to her elderly family in the eastern states. I only found out about 10 minutes ago. It's such an incredible shock. I mean, it takes me back to the announcement that, so ironically, that Russell was the one that announced on air that Wally Foreman died so suddenly back in 2006. But you just couldn't meet a more gregarious, I guess, caring person. I mean, a lot of your audience will know that I've been through my trials with mental health, and my wife Karen Tyers had some real physical health battles, and the support that Russell gave both of us through that time was just quite incredible. He was a big cuddly, and that's the thing, every time you saw him, if I bumped into him every now and then in recent years in Rockaby Road, you just get this great big bear hug from him. He was just the most gregarious, caring, loving person, and I can just imagine that everyone, his wife Bronte, his wife Kylie's daughter Bronte, everyone today would just be in a complete state of shock, because we've lost someone who's a very special person. He was one of those people that there was no difference behind the microphone to the man you met in the street. He was just a knockabout Aussie bloke, and everyone loved him.
Mm. Well, we've spoken to a couple of people this morning privately off air who worked with Russell as well. And I think the word that comes to mind is inconsolable. It has come as such a shock. And I think the people who knew him best are really struggling to keep a lid on those emotions.
And understandably so. I mean, as my wife said, you know, she was just talking to him in the office yesterday morning, and you know, he's just one of those people that always had a smile on his face. It didn't matter what he was going through in his personal circumstances. He'd always just be this ebullient, bright, bubbly, and he was larger than life with the great big mop of hair. And safe to say, he wasn't the fittest individual, Russ, when it came to his appearance. He always looked like an unmade bed. but people just loved him. I used to always say to him when I saw him, I say, mate, you've been dragged through a hedge backwards more times than anyone I know. The hair and unruly and everything. But even when he presented the TV weather on the ABC, I think for about 4 years, he just did it in an inimitable Russell Wolf style. He wasn't sort of the well-groomed television presenter that he would normally be used to be seeing. But I mean, I can just imagine that everyone today that is just getting this news now, whether it's through social media, through radio, through websites, whatever, I just think they'd be totally shocked. As I said, I think back, and I have great sympathy today, aside from his family, but a wonderful young man by the name of Brad McCann, who produced Ian Cameron, and of course Ian died extremely suddenly in a similar circumstance, and now he's been producing Russell, and the same thing has happened in the early hours of this morning. But yeah, he was just a lovable soul, and sort of a gregarious, a raconteur. He loved to hold an audience, whether it was over the radio, whether it was over a few drinks at the local bar or his bowling club that he loved. So it's just a tragic day. It really is. WA's lost a very special person, and a very kind and loving person.
And let's talk about Russell the broadcaster. He hosted Drive and then infamously gave an on-air resignation in December 2013, which was just, you know, classic Rusty. But he said he said at the time that he thought he'd be back on the ABC at some stage. He had a run at the WA Senate, which didn't work out. But then he found himself back on the ABC, and the ratings have been really great in the last couple of surveys. What do you think it says about him as a broadcaster that he persisted as long as he did and had such great success and was so beloved by the ABC audience?
Yeah, and I think he found his niche in breakfast radio. I think, you know, the Drive program, where it was more perhaps doing political interviews and that type of thing. I mean, he was a smart man, university educated and the likes, but I think his style was best suited to a light-hearted breakfast program, and that's the way that he ran it. I mean, it was interspersed with, you know, serious interviews and the likes, but, you know, he was a storyteller, and he was someone that could just connect with the man and woman in the street. As I said before, there was no airs and graces about Russell. He was just a knockabout bloke, and he took that personality. He spoke to you on the radio as if he was talking to you over the bar at his local lawn bowls club. He loved his lawn bowls. But yeah, he just had a way of being able to connect with the audience, and I think because of the fact he the audience probably saw him as being just one of them, and I think that's one of the great tributes to any broadcast that's doing a program like that. It's different if you're doing current affairs and 7:30 report or anything like that, but if you are just doing a radio program that and your personality links with the listener as if you're just a mate of theirs, then I think that's a tremendous strength, and Russell had that ability. I mean, it used to be, when I was working with him, it would be quite strange. You'd see him rock into the office in his pair of thongs and shorts, and you'd find out that the Premier was coming in later that morning. It didn't have Russell race home and go and change. He never had a spare pair of shoes sitting around the office anyway. He was just such a casual, lovable character. And I think that even though it was radio and you couldn't see him, I think a lot of people that had seen him on doing the weather and everything could picture in his mind when he was talking what he'd look like in a dishevelled state at 5:10 when he pressed the microphone button to go on a Monday morning after a reasonably buoyant and entertaining weekend he would have had with his family.
Yeah, and I think it's a measure of how well he was liked around town, that it doesn't matter what media organisation you're working for today.
Yeah.
There are a lot of misty eyes thinking about Rusty today. I think everybody in the media had a beer with him at some point. He emceed so many community events over the years, and anybody who attended one will attest to just how awesome he was in that role. Just so personable, so warm, so funny, which came across in his work as well. How do you think their feeling of the ABC today?
I think it'll be devastation. I think that they'll be just walking around in a cloud, in a haze at the moment. You just don't expect something like this. I mean, even when Wally passed away, and that was devastating. We had sort of pre-warning of that. He'd been in hospital for a few days after a severe heart attack. But for us to have been there on air yesterday morning and be entertaining everyone with his big loud laugh and everything, and given bear hugs before he would have left work yesterday morning to go home. I mean, just for him not to be there today, I just can't imagine. I know that my former colleague Jeff Hutchinson's on air at the moment, and trying to obviously hold it together, and it will just be a day of tributes. The radio will be given over, as you're quite kindly doing now on your station. I mean, the radio will just be given over on the ABC today to memories of a man who. And I guess I said before that the one thing is that radio is such an intimate medium. And, there'll be a lot of people out there that are widows or widowers or people that drive long-distance trucks or whatever, that Russell's a mate. Russell's someone who's been in their truck cab with them, or has been around the breakfast table with them if you are living on your own or whatever. A lot of people today will feel like they've lost a member of their extended family. And I can only... My heart goes out to everyone at the ABC, my former colleagues, and of course at the top of the list, Kylie Bronte and all of Russell's family today.
Mm. I think a lot of people in the media also feel like they've lost a loved one as well, because that's how beloved Russell Wolf was. Former ABC broadcaster Glenn Mitchell, a tough day today. We hope you get through it as best as possible, and everybody close to you. And our thoughts are definitely with Russell's family and everyone close to him today. Thanks for joining us and sharing these feelings and anecdotes about the great man on the West Live.
Good on you, mate. Thanks very much.
What do you think of that, Clarkie? It's tough. It's tough to listen to, isn't it?
Oh, and as Glenn said, Glenn was part of the ABC family for so long, and then, as he mentioned, had his issues and had to step away. I think Glenn was best man at Wally Foreman's wedding, and so that impacted Glenn and the wider community hugely. And I don't think I'm out of place in saying that Russell's loss will be felt as hard as that today in the studio at Fielder Street, obviously, and then in the wider community, because he was, as Glenn said, just a sort of part of the furniture, that comfy old couch that you just slip into at the start of the day and previously at the end of the day to watch the weather or listen to him on the radio, and to have that comfort taken away so suddenly will be felt everywhere, I think.
Yeah, and we'll be talking more about it in the days to come. Now, Clarkie, let's talk about some news. And listeners might remember a few months ago, there was a wave of arrests of high-level criminal and bikie gangs, not just here in WA, but all over the world. This was this Operation Ironside, which involved encrypted apps that were created by the FBI as a Trojan horse to get into some of these illegal operations. It was more like a movie than real life. And now police working in that same operation are preparing to make some more arrests. Can you tell us what's going on?
Yeah, so yeah, Ironside was the operation on the back of an app called Anom, and it was marketed to criminals as your ultimate encrypted device where you could talk about all your nefarious deeds and no one would be able to listen to it. Unfortunately for them, the FBI and numerous law enforcement agencies around the world were listening, because it was their app and they'd built it, they designed it, and then they sold it. They actually sold it to the criminals so they could listen to them. Earlier in the year, a massive global operation, really. And yesterday, AFP Commissioner Rhys Kershaw went before the Senate's committee at Federal Parliament to give the parliamentarians an update state of what was happening. Over 300 people charged, 29 lives saved, Commissioner Kershaw said, because they were threats to kill, credible threats to kill on that app that they acted on. Over 5 tons of drugs, $50 million in cash, and they haven't stopped there because they've gone from very, very covert to very, very overt. And Commissioner Kershaw said in Parliament and before the world yesterday, we've got another wave coming up, so don't be surprised if you were using that app that you get a knock on the door very soon. And obviously we know that the... A bulk of organised crime in this state certainly is done by bikie gangs, and we know the government have, on the one hand, launched the toughest laws ever on bikie gangs, and we're pretty sure that there's this Ironside 2.0 or whatever they're going to call it will be targeting the bikies as well.
And so, when do you think we will see some of these arrests being made? Is there any idea of a timeline?
Well, that's an interesting one. I mean, you mentioned it in Parliament before. Christina Keneally's question.
Is that the way it's supposed to work?
Well, that's the thing. So they've got, as I say, they've gone from so covert, and now they know that they've broken the back of some of the major organisations, or hopefully in the world, and they were very very open about. Parading how they'd done it eventually, and now they seem to want to sort of let the criminals know that, well, you think you might have got away with it, but you haven't. Timeline? Well, who knows? I mean, it could be today, it could be next week. And I wouldn't have thought that they'd be putting that on their social media feeds that will be knocking on your door next Thursday, or you might get a few runners to the border. But now he's said it, I think you'll find that his officers and agents will probably follow up quite quickly.
Yeah, do you think some of his officers on the ground are probably thinking, mate, come on now.
Yeah.
Well, we would have preferred if this was kept commercial in confidence.
I was listening to it yesterday thinking, wow, his agents, I wonder if they knew that were coming, and B, if they knew it was coming so soon. So, the Ironside really did put a dent here. So we've had more than 20 people charged. In one case, $6 million was seized from a house in Girraween, of all places, and that has now been confiscated and put into the state coffers. And one of the chaps that was involved in that particular money got 5 years in prison. And reading the transcript from the court yesterday, he was just literally employed to bundle up the money. Count it, bundle it, pack it, and send it on its way to the big bosses over east. And he got 5 years in prison. So they're not messing about. And obviously, this is bickies, 5 tons of drugs. And Commissioner Kershaw said in Parliament yesterday, when they were actually rolling out Ironside, so when all the search warrants were done in that short amount of time, he said in real time they had 10 tons of drugs on the water on their way to Australia at that moment.
Wow.
Which he said even took them by surprise, because they couldn't believe the scale of it, and they couldn't believe the breadth of it. And they were also quite worried, that showed what the appetite for illicit drugs in Australia still is. I mean, you've had Tom Percy on the Westlife many times talking about the failure of the war on drugs. Well, 10 tons on their way, presumably with a market to sell it to, sort of speaks to that... that war on drugs still struggling to make a dent.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's like you take a little bit away, but there's still so much more. It's like the iceberg, much of it under the waterline.
Yeah, well, that's right.
And now let's move on to another big revelation in the news today, which you've been at ground zero for. So this Victorian Royal Commission into Crown has found the company unfit to run a casino in Melbourne. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's right. So... I've been covering the Crown Royal Commission in Perth, obviously, for the last few months. The Crown Royal Commission in Melbourne has been going on parallel. And today, Commissioner Ray Finkelstein handed his report, or the report was actually released. He handed it over last week. And it could not have been more scathing, more damning, and more critical of Crown's operations in Melbourne. And I'm sure there are thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people in Perth that have visited South Bank, been into that casino for whatever reason, to gamble or to party or to do both. But what Ray Finkelstein said there is that company was basically just a cowboy operation, a law unto itself, and he's gone whack and said, you don't deserve your license. But on balancing the or everything that he's heard, he's decided that he shouldn't take that license away from Crown, because it would have a massive impact on the Victoria, its society, and presumably its budget. And so he said that they're going to employ a special manager for the next 2 years to basically be the sheriff, to try and rein in those outlaws. And if the sheriff comes back in 2 years and said, "Nah, you still haven't tidied up your house," then the license will go. So he could have gone harder, obviously, but he's gone pretty hard. And this will have a knock-on impact here, because the Royal Commission is still going here. It's actually going today. James Packer, the current biggest shareholder still in Crown, is due to give evidence to our Royal Commission on Friday. They will be listening and reading and digesting all of this, the commissioners here, and I'm sure they will take some of it on board, some of the findings, and possibly some of the recommendations and the ideas that Commissioner Finkelstein's come up with.
Yeah, because it's interesting to think about, like, how much something that happens at a Royal Commission over East influences what we do here, because there was always already one in New South Wales, now this Victorian one, both found very similar things. Do you think that, if not necessarily prejudices what happens here in WA, puts a little bit more of extra pressure to, you know, not pull any punches?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's definitely true. But this has been completely unique. The sort of the Bergen inquiry, as you mentioned, was the original inquiry that found that Crown weren't fit to run the Sydney casino. And then on the back of that, the Royal Commissions here and in Melbourne were announced. And they've run side by side, and they've actually helped each other. In both of the rules around the commissions, they were allowed to swap notes and swap findings and swap material, because Crown was just giving them, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of documents. And so they've been helping each other along the way, which is quite unique, I think, in Royal Commission history anyway. But as you say, Perth will be last. WA wait a while, all that. So March will be the findings now. It was due to be next month, but the government has given them more time. And I think it will then shine the spotlight onto Neville Owen and his two fellow commissioners to say and see, well, you know, what's gone on in Sydney, what's gone on in Melbourne. We know bad things have gone on in Perth, certainly money laundering, problem gambling has not been a priority at all here. And the main focus, or one of the main focuses, has been the electronic gaming machines, which it appears now are just pokies by stealth. They're the only place in the state that allowed to have them. They generated $300 million in cash last year.
Wow.
$300 million. I could not believe that when I read that in the annual report. In 1 year, through those pokies...
Pokies, electronic gaming machines.
Sorry, I was doing the inverted commas in the air there. That's not a good
that
word
works
for radio.
Well,
yeah,
on radio.
Yeah. And there's 2,500 of those machines. So you can do the math yourself and work out how much money each machine generates. And through the questioning, Crown have been critiqued quite strongly on those and the impact they have on WA society. So, yeah, come March, it will be very interesting to see what our commissioners say. And in the next few days, it'll be very interesting to see what some of the Crown heavy hitters have to say after what Commissioner Finkelstein had to say today.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the West Australian's legal affairs editor, Tim Clark, it's always insightful having you into the studio. It's nice actually having you here in person, I have to say. And you're not, because you're not out at a Royal Commission or in a courtroom or
chasing some
crook somewhere. Clarky, thanks for joining us on the West Live. We'll talk to you again soon.
Always a pleasure, mate. Cheers.
Now, every day we're hearing a new development in the disappearance of 4-year-old Cleo Smith. And today is no different, with the news that CCTV has reportedly been seized by police in a desperate new bid to try and find the little girl. And as police try and find her, her face, her innocent smile, heartbroken parents and disturbing, terrifying emails are plastered all over the newspaper, TV and on our phones. And our kids are constantly in contact with the details. So how do we talk to our kids about something so incomprehensible? Joining me now is health and community psychologist Marnie Lishman. Good morning, Marnie.
Good morning.
And so it's a terrible situation and one that parents might feel could be a teachable moment, but how do you even begin to approach it when you're talking about this type of thing with your kids?
Yeah, Oh, it's so difficult. And this one's particularly difficult because it's so close to home, isn't it? And it involves a little child. Whereas a lot of the world events, I guess, recently, it almost feels like it's far away, particularly when they're natural disasters and things. And there's almost like you can have that conversation about distance and separation. But when it's so close to home, it can be incredibly difficult. But I really would start with only discussing this if your children come to you with the questions. Like, don't unnecessarily distress them if it's not on their radar. So I reckon that would be my first tip.
Well, that's actually a great piece of advice. So what do you think would happen? Like, how does it, can it potentially, I guess, be something that a child will struggle to process? And what can be the impact of that if you just go to them unprovoked and say, well, look, this is what's happened. This kid's been snatched. Is it potential for like creating nightmares? What is the impact?
Yes. As you can imagine, that's any child's worst nightmare, isn't it? To not be around their parents or be taken away. And that is the stuff of nightmares, even when these things aren't happening in the world or kids don't know that it actually can happen. So I think, if kids do find out about this or they're watching the news, all children, I think, whatever age, their anxiety is going to be provoked. They're going to be very distressed. They're going to be very hyper alert and hypersensitive and very fearful. I think a lot of kids are going to be asking questions, whether they're listening to the news in the car on the way to school or they're seeing it on the telly or if it's just coming up on news feeds in social media for teenagers. There's going to be a lot of questions asked to parents because everything's very heightened because our brains are about survival. So anything that our brain perceives or that could psychologically harm us or physically harm us, we pay attention to it, and kids want to be informed of what's going on in the world, and they will ask questions to their parents, and it's up to parents to soothe them so they don't actually get even more anxious than they already are.
So how should we be discussing this with our kids when they come to us and ask about it?
Yeah, well, like we said before, unless they come and ask you, there's no point in distressing. So if they do, you need to give them age-appropriate information. So the little ones, probably they might ask a few questions, but they don't want lengthy information given to them. Often this is called dosing. So if a little kid, probably under primary school age, starts seeing things on TV and things like that, you just need short, sharp answers. And then keep them feeling soothed and safe. So it's just reassurance. And often you'll find that little kids, because they don't want all the information that adults want, they just disappear and go off playing again. So in most parts, they'll be okay with a little bit of information, and then you just make them feel safe and sound. And you can also say you don't know. So another thing with adults, I think we over-talk things too much. But like all of us at the moment, particularly with this case, we don't have the answers, do we? So it is okay to say, I don't know. With the primary school kids, you can give them a little bit more information and just tell them that it's actually a rare event. It doesn't happen very much, and that we are safe and secure in our own home. So again, even primary school ages, answer their questions with short, sharp responses. And you can say, I don't know, but you bring it back to their own life and let them know how safe and secure they are. And teens, you can give them a little bit more information. But again, we don't have all the information, do we, as adults? So we're allowed to say, I don't know.
And what about if it's impacting parents? What are the warning signs, and what can you do about that?
Oh, yeah, I think we're all heightened at the moment, aren't we? Any event like this where something in reality has actually frightened us, and then as a response we feel very, very fearful. But those emotions are actually really important for us, because it makes us do things in our behaviours to make sure that in the future that we are safe and secure and sound. That's why anxiety is such a useful emotion to have at times, because it makes us action things to make sure that if we're in situations like that in the future, that we make sure that we put things into place. And this is what these kind of rare events do, don't they? They make us hypersensitive for a period of time, we do something about it. We try and soothe ourselves and make ourselves feel better. And then over time, we just move on. So, yeah, this is an interesting case because it is a rare event that these sorts of things happen, but it makes us very heightened. And we just have to make sure that we practice self-care if we're finding this distressing.
Yeah, I think that's a very important message. Just really be mindful of how you're feeling and don't try and bury things. Try and deal with them and look after yourselves. Because it's very, very hard to process.
Exactly.
Health and community psychologist Dr. Marnie Lishman, thanks for joining us again on The West Live.
Thank you.
You're listening to The West Live.
WA is world-renowned for its produce and wine, and producers will get the chance to showcase the best of the West to its own when the first ever Meet the Buyer exhibition takes place this week. Joining me now is Deborah Pett, Manager of Food Industry Development at the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development. Good morning, Deborah.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
Yeah, great, thanks. So can you tell us what Meet the Buyer is and what's the significance of it?
Listen, I'd describe it a bit like speed dating, only with a business lens over the top of it. We've created an amazing forum, first of its kind really here in Western Australia, bespoke for local food and beverage producers who we match up with buyers from right across WA. So it extends to supermarkets, to food service, to chefs. You know, we have hotels like Pan Pacific there, Woolworths, Coles, Farmer Jacks, Metcash, a lot of distributors. So, you know, for some of these producers, often quite small, the opportunity of actually pitching in front of some of these bigger type of retail or food service chains is just a dream, you know, that they could only ever have imagined. So we've provided a forum for them to come together, pitch their wares. There'll be over 450 branded products there, 70 business, you know, pitching their wares. We've probably got 30 to 40 buyers in total. Probably the room will be 350-odd or more people. So we're really excited.
Wow. And so this is happening at Crown on Wednesday. And so it's a bit like a one of those sort of good food and wine festivals, but for the industry, for the hospitality and retail industry.
Correct. And Western Australian producers only. So that's another rather unique feature of it. And it's part of our Buy, Rest, Eat Best program, which is the only food and beverage labelling program in Australia that helps consumers to identify what is 100% farm fish processed and prepared here in Western Australia.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm of course familiar, as everybody in Western Australia is, of the Buy West, Eat Best message. But I'm curious to know, how has the pandemic impacted supply chains and, I guess, changed the impact of that message?
Well, WA, as we know, is a pretty parochial sort of state. That desert between us and the baddies on the East Coast has always driven a pretty strong local support. But I think COVID-19 has even endorsed that further. People really want to support their local producers, their local farmers, their local shops. And so this message is even more powerful than anything. In fact, 8 out of 10 consumers are looking for local produce to support because they know it's good for the Western Australian economy.
Mm. And we really do it all here in WA, don't we? From, you know, the humble potato at one end of the spectrum to, you know, black truffles, crayfish at the other end.
Correct. We've really got a diversity of product. You have to start with pretty damn good fresh produce to start with. But then when, you know, you add the different layers of value to it, it just increases the premium nature of that product.
Mm. And we know worker shortages have impacted hospitality industry, but we also know it's also been very difficult for agricultural businesses to get workers. How has that, I guess, made it more difficult for these WA producers to get their products into stores and restaurants?
Well, it has added an incredible challenge. You know, normally we would have something of the order of 14,000 holiday maker visa people here in our state. And they're really attracted, obviously, to WA for what the, you know, beautiful environment it has to offer. But it's all about an experience. So they tend to chase the sort of seasonal pickings, if you like. So they start up in the north and then move down to the southwest. Well, they're not here, sadly, as a reflection, obviously, of COVID-19 and our hard borders, both international and interstate. So a number of the food services have really been put under extraordinary pressure. A number of them are probably operating at suboptimal levels because they haven't been able to get the staff. Others have had to look for really innovative ways of how do we recruit more people, how do we actually look for actually in our own backyard. And then the added complication with that is accommodation is really, really tough in regional Western Australia because of the very buoyant tourism, because no one can go anywhere. Mm. So, you know, within the farming community, their farms are working together now in terms of sharing that workforce. A number of the, you know, the banana plantations and our businesses are working together to share that workforce. So it is creating some very innovative and often pivotal to what their normal business models are. But I would ask Western Australians to really, you know, take a bit of a breath when you're actually going to some of those regional communities that aren't used to the extraordinary demand, and just have a bit of an understanding that, you know, these businesses are under pressure because they just haven't got the labour force they normally would, and unheralded sort of tourism demand, which is fantastic. But, you know, there's a pivot and a, you know, challenge there because of that workforce shortages.
Now let's turn back to the Meet the Buyer exhibition happening tomorrow. So there's going to be a lot of deals done, no doubt, whether it's the sommeliers, the restaurant owners, the supermarkets who are coming across all of these interesting WA-made products. In your opinion, do you have a favourite? Do you have something that, you know, that you'd be particularly excited about showcasing tomorrow?
Ben, I'm not going to do that. You're not going to put me on the spot, given that our own BioEstate Desk program has over 200 members. So I'm not going to single out. But it is an amazing opportunity, and particularly for those smaller businesses, as I said earlier. And there's also businesses that are attending that are not pitching. They're just looking at what are the requirements if we want to get into that retail channel that we have to do to actually make it. So there's a lot of business development opportunities as well as businesses checking out what the opposition looks like. So it is an amazing forum that we're extraordinarily excited about.
Yeah, well, I hope it goes well, and I hope you allow yourself to have a glass of WA-made sparkling wine at the conclusion. Deborah Pett, Manager of Food Industry Development at the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development, thanks for joining us on The West Live.
Thanks, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
The Wild West.
Joining me now in the studio is The West Online's Kate Phillips. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
It's a tough day in the Perth media today with the loss of Russell Wolfe. I think everybody has a story about Rusty. I interviewed him a bunch of times, bumped into him at gigs around town because he loved local music. He was a passionate supporter of local music. You have a Russell Wolfe story as well.
Yeah, and I don't know him as well as other people knew him. But yeah, so I used to work for Triple J when I first started out in broadcasting, and I would do lots of really random shifts at the ABC, and I would quite often bump into him. You know, he'd be there at random times as well, and he was always so lovely. I think that's probably the one thing that stuck with me is just how kind he was, and how, you know, he'd always have a bit of a chat or say something or at least acknowledge you, and particularly when you're working in that sort of role, not with other people. It was just so nice because not everyone would do that, you know, particularly someone of his, I guess, sort of status as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that's the one of the key things about his personality. He would have a chat to anyone and would take any opportunity to do so, whether he was walking down the street, he would hardly go 10 steps before someone would yell out to him, and he would always respond with kindness, and it is a very tough day. Like, we've been contacting people who've worked with him, and they're just devastated.
It's just such a shock, I think. I don't think you sort of wake up expecting to hear that kind of news, but, you know, especially people that knew him well.
Yeah. He was on radio yesterday.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. Yeah. I did a bit of work experience with him as well, and he just, you know, I think I heard Andrea Byrne talking about the fact that he, you know, was always in talking with WAPA students and that sort of thing, and I was one of those WAPA students that was sent over there to work experience, and he was just awesome, just treated you like everyone else.
Was, yep. Yeah. They're just a generous man.
Yeah.
And now let's talk about the other big story in WA, this ongoing search for little Cleo. And there's been some news from the police.
Yeah, that's right. So there was sort of talk of police going and doing a big search along Northwest Coastal Highway and obtaining footage, I guess, from all the houses and the businesses. And it looks like they've obtained some CCTV from a home on Northwest Coastal Highway that does have a car that was apparently spotted about 3 a.m. in the morning. So I don't know if you remember when they were talking about originally there were claims of screeching tyres nearby around that time, and then there was a credible source that came forward and said, look, we did see a car in that area, and now it seems that they've got CCTV that shows our car. So, it's actually a very big lead.
Yeah, and I think any little piece of information is being jumped upon by the public, like so desperate to know what has happened to little Cleo. And I think it's important to remember that at this stage, it's obviously still an ongoing investigation, and it might not turn out to be the breakthrough that we're all hoping for. But I think that police are certainly taking it very seriously and will be throwing a ton of resources into figuring out exactly what this car was doing and who was in it. And all we can do is hope that that there's a resolution.
Yeah. Or if they have information, you know, it may not even be something that's sinister. You know,
yeah,
if they're around
right.
there at 3 a.m. in the morning.
They might just have some information that could be helpful.
Exactly.
And now let's talk about Chappelle Corby. It's someone who I don't really think about that much. What was the reality TV show that she was in recently?
Was it SAS?
I wondered if it was SAS, but I think it was maybe, was it Dancing with the Stars? Maybe both. I think she's done a few.
She's back out there.
Yeah, she's getting out there, and now she's been in WA. Is that correct?
Yeah. So she snuck in a trip apparently. So she's only just posted about it because she's obviously she can't do much. I think she's in lockdown. She was saying, and she's like, well, while I've got a bit of time, I'm just going to post all of these photos. So yeah, she snuck over here and went to the Northwest. And
oh wow,
yeah.
Where does she live? She's a Queenslander, right?
Yeah,
is she from the Gold Coast.
Yep.
I remember back to the infamous boogie board.
Oh, yes. Yes. Controversy.
Debacle in Bali. I'm pretty sure she flew to Bali from the Goldie.
Yeah, she is. And I think, you know, they've just had a few more cases and she's like, I'm just going to post all this and relive when I visited.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And so what did she do while she was up there?
Oh, she went everywhere. So she's been photographed at some of the most beautiful falls. And I don't know why the name escapes me. The falls up in the Northwest. But she's posted it to, I think she's got 162,000 followers.
Wow. She's an influencer.
She is. So it's a really good thing, I guess, for that area as well. You know, I mean, it's so beautiful anyway, people sort of, but yeah, for her to give it that sort of that push as well. And Jessica Gomes has commented on it, saying, you look like you're having the time of your life. So yeah, it's getting a bit of reach. So
yeah. Well, she became, now I've been reminded by my producers that she became a bit of an unexpected fan favourite on SAS Australia in the first episode when she said she refused to be defined by her drug smuggling past. And she pulled the pin during a pretty brutal running challenge where she was struggling to keep up with the other recruits.
Yeah, that's so right. And I do remember, I thought it was SAS, but yeah. I'm just trying to see where she went. So, of course, Karajini National Park, but I just can't see the falls. She went to all the hot spots.
Yeah. Well, good on her. And now let's talk about true crime. Everybody's obsessed with it. And there's potentially a new victim of American serial killer John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah, that's right. So we're talking, you know, how many years later? So a long, long time later. So they think they've identified one of his victims. So they actually, this is truly awful, but they removed a lot of bodies from a crawl space in his home. And they've had his, I guess, remains for a very long time. And they've managed to, I think it's through a group that's come together, and they've managed to get one of his teeth and identify his DNA that way. And all this time later, they've been able to tell his family that he was one of his victims.
And you know what, people, it goes back a while, and a lot of people in Australia might not be familiar with John Wayne Gacy. He was known apparently as the Killer Clown.
Yes.
And regularly performed at children's hospitals and charitable events as Pogo the Clown, or Patches the Clown, as actually a clown.
Yep.
Is assaulted and murdered at least 33 young men and boys.
That's right. I mean, that was before before they found all of these bodies as well. So that's what he was convicted of. And the guy's the man's name was Francis Wayne Alexander. So it seems he would have been 21 or 22 when he was killed.
What a sicko.
Yeah, awful. But it's he honestly, I don't know if you've seen photos, but John Wayne Gacy actually looked like it.
Yeah. It's just horrible. And now the Federal Tourism Minister, Dan Tehan, has given hope to everybody today who is maybe dreaming of going back to Bali for a holiday. He thinks it might not be too long until we go back there.
Yeah, look, they're predicting Christmas.
Wow.
I know.
Not for Western Australians, of course.
No, but this is the thing, right? Unless you went to, you know, Sydney and, you know, went over there and tried to stay and did your, what is it? I keep saying vaccination, but it's not. It's, you know, when you, oh my gosh. When you sit in a room for 2 weeks.
Oh, quarantine.
Isolation.
You've been in isolation.
I have. Oh my gosh.
But this is the interesting thing, right? Like, I don't know why they've singled out Bali. Like, I get the feeling it's very political, right? Like, they know that they can appeal to, you know, maybe some of those vaccine hesitant and people who have got various other issues. They're thinking Bali. That's how we win those people over.
Exactly.
We're going to hold the carrot of going to Kuta and buying some bintang over their heads, and all of a sudden we'll be looking very sweet going into the next federal election.
Absolutely. It's that whole broom, you know, Bali before broom sort of push, just to really push it, I think, to West Aussies in particular and say, look, you know, if you ever want to get back there, you're going to have to get vaccinated. But you know what, at this stage, I'm not sure even that will work.
No, I think you might be absolutely right.
Yeah.
Kate Phillips from The West Online, thank you for joining us in the studio today. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it from me. Good to have your company, folks. We'll be back tomorrow live from 8:45 a.m. You can download the full show or individual interviews by searching for The West Live wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on the west.com.au to deliver.